The headlines: Russian troops gain full control of the strategic port of Kherson, the first major Ukrainian city falling into Russian hands on the eighth day of the conflict. Ukraine and Russia preparing to return to the negotiating table days after concluding their first face-to-face talks with no clear breakthrough. And a court in Denmark sentences three leaders of an anti-Iran terror group to up to 8 years in prison after convicting them of spying for Saudi Arabia. Hello and welcome, everybody. Moscow's military operation in Ukraine is in its eighth day with Russian forces further advancing in the country. The mayor of Kherson has confirmed the Russian troops are now in control of the strategic port city. This is the first significant urban center to fall since Moscow launched its attack. Heavy clashes are also underway in the capital, Kiev, as well as Kharkiv, Ukraine's second largest city. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe says a Ukrainian member of its team was killed in the Kharkiv bombing. Meantime, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has hailed the people's resilience and resistance.
The morale of the enemy is deteriorating. More and more occupiers are fleeing back to Russia. I sincerely admire the heroic resistance of our people and those that do not allow the occupiers to pass through, blocking everything for them, blocking roads. People come out in front of enemy vehicles. This is extremely dangerous, but how courageous.
The fighting began last Thursday after Russian President Vladimir Putin authorized a special military operation in Ukraine. The UN Refugee Agency says more than 1 million people have fled to neighboring countries since then. Russia's defense ministry says it has lost around 500 of its troops in the fighting so far. A UN report has put the number of civilian deaths in Ukraine at 230, saying the actual figure is likely much higher. The Russian delegation has arrived for the second round of talks between Kiev and Moscow. The Russian team arrived at the Belarus-Poland border where the negotiations are to take place. The Ukrainian side is on its way and is expected to arrive on Thursday. The two sides are likely to agree on a meeting place as well as discuss the possibility of a ceasefire and the establishment of a humanitarian corridor. Russia and Ukraine concluded their first round of negotiations in Belarus on Monday with no clear breakthrough. Well, Russia is hit with more sanctions as the conflict between Moscow and Kiev continues unabated. The U.S. government has announced a new round of sanctions on Russia, including measures that ban the export of specific technologies to its oil refinery sector. Washington has also blacklisted over a dozen of Russian entities with ties to the country's military and defense sectors. Meanwhile, the European Union has excluded seven Russian banks from the global SWIFT payment system. The bloc has also banned two major news networks, namely Russia Today and Sputnik. In recent days, Moscow has retaliated with sanctions and restrictions of its own. Moscow has also warned that Germany's decision to freeze the Nord Stream 2 project would damage ties irrevocably and lead to a rapid and inevitable rise in gas prices. The United Nations General Assembly votes overwhelmingly to deplore Russia's military operation against Ukraine. The 193-member body has adopted a resolution that calls on Russia to withdraw its troops from Ukraine. During the emergency session, 141 members voted in favor of the resolution. Five countries, including Russia, said no, while 35 others abstained. Addressing the meeting, Ukraine's ambassador accused Moscow of seeking to commit genocide in his country. Sergei Kislytsia warned that if, quote, Russia's aggression is not stopped, it will spill over to other areas. However, the Russian representative criticized the resolution, saying it might spark further escalation. Vasily Nebenzia blamed Ukraine and its Western allies for the ongoing conflict and accused them of killing people in the Donbass region. He also dismissed claims that the Russian military had targeted civilians. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has made his stance clear when it comes to Russia's military operation against Ukraine. He has said the root causes of the problem lie in the wrong U.S. policies. But while many parties have voiced concerns about the ongoing crisis in Ukraine, it's frustrating to see the double standards in place when dealing with other crises in the world, like the war on Yemen or the Israeli violence towards Palestinians and the countless deaths they've caused.
Leader of the Islamic Revolution Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has blamed the American regime for the current Ukraine crisis. He demanded an end to the war in Ukraine, saying the Islamic Republic of Iran has always opposed war and destruction anywhere in the world. The U.S. disrupted the stability of the country by interfering in its affairs and organizing rallies and creating a color coup. We oppose the killing of people and the destruction of the infrastructure of nations. Leader called the U.S. a perfect example and manifestation of modern ignorance, saying it feeds off the crises it creates all around the world.
Washington are glorified mobsters. That's all. America does to all of its allies. You've got to remember, there's a very good saying, if you're an American enemy, they might bribe you and bring you into their team. If you're their ally, good luck to you, sir.
Ayatollah Khamenei is referring to years of U.S. meddling in Ukraine since it became an independent state in 1990s. After the fall of the Soviet Union, the U.S. pledged not to expand NATO eastward close to the borders with Russia. But the U.S. and its Western allies reneged their pledges and started to include more Eastern European countries into the Western military alliance. In 2014, the U.S. implemented a color revolution in Ukraine and overthrew its democratically elected government. U.S. also supported the inclusion of right-wing groups and elements within Ukraine's government. It's now widely believed that in trying to move Ukraine into their orbit, Washington and its European allies overextended themselves. And Russia's intervention, firstly in facilitating Crimea's reunification with Moscow in 2014, then with the official recognition of the independence and sovereignty of the People's Republics of Donetsk and Luhansk, and now with a wider military operation to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine, is the result.
Iran's leader pointed out to a misconception among many countries who fall into the orbit of U.S. foreign policy. He said that Western powers cannot be trusted since their promise of support will never materialize. He cited Afghanistan as one clear example. Also, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, another negative U.S. attribute is that it feeds off the conflicts and crises that it creates around the globe.
Elsewhere, in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei said there are lessons to be drawn with regard to the Ukraine crisis. He said Western powers cannot be trusted and their support for their puppet regimes is only, quote, a mirage. Iran's leader said both Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and former Afghan President Ashraf Ghani have acknowledged that the U.S. simply abandoned them amid their domestic crises. As the crisis unfolded in Ukraine, the country's president, Zelensky, rude being left alone by the West. The U.S. has refused to send in soldiers to the country to protect its people and has only pledged more money and weapons.
Well, the Ukrainian president was basically helped into power by American advisors and American campaign organizers. The Ukrainian president was told that he could go ahead and put down by force the Donbass ethnic Russians who revolted after the government in Ukraine banned their language and restricted their ethnic autonomy.
The same scenario happened in Afghanistan, when after 20 years of occupation, the U.S. disastrously pulled out of the country, leaving President Ghani and Afghan people alone in the face of Taliban fighters. The U.S. is facing backlash over its treatment of its Arab allies. Despite selling them weapons worth billions of dollars and pledging support, it has failed to provide them with sustainable security.
More desperate. They put you in a more serious situation than you were before, and the terms that they dictate to you are much, much more demanding than it would have been had you not taken the actions that they allowed you to take at the first. So Zelensky took actions against his own ethnic Russian citizens at the bidding of the United States, at their will.
It's now become apparent that the failure of successive U.S. presidents and their European allies since the end of the Soviet era has been to overestimate their own power and underestimate that of Russia, China, Iran, and other countries that are outside their sphere of influence.
According to Denmark, sentences three leaders of an anti-Iran terror group to up to 8 years in prison over espionage. Habib Yaburkabi, his brother Tamim Faruk Bek, and son-in-law belong to the so-called Arab Struggle Movement for the Liberation of Ahvaz. Last month, the Danish court found them guilty of creating a spy unit for a Saudi intelligence service. They were also convicted of promoting terrorism. In September 2018, the terrorist group claimed responsibility for an attack on a military parade in Ahvaz, which killed 25 people. Iran has in the past said the group is backed by Saudi Arabia. Iran's foreign minister says the revival of the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA hinges on political decisions and a realistic approach by the U.S. and Europe. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the comment in a phone call with his Chinese counterpart Wang Yi. He added the JCPOA revival talks must safeguard Iran's interests. The top Chinese diplomat for his part said Beijing supports Iran's rational demands in the Vienna talks. Iran and the remaining parties to the deal are still engaged in negotiations in the Austrian capital. Tehran says the talks must lead to the verifiable removal of U.S. sanctions. It also wants guarantees that Washington will not abandon the deal again as it did back in 2018. Elsewhere, Iran has once again called for the release of Afghanistan's frozen assets, saying the economic revival and people's livelihood in the war-torn nation should not be politicized. Speaking at a UN Security Council meeting on Afghanistan, Iran's deputy ambassador called for urgent actions to prevent the Afghan economy from collapsing. Zahra Ershadi noted that nearly half of Afghanistan's population is in dire need of humanitarian assistance. The Iranian diplomat also expressed deep concerns over the catastrophic consequences of the situation for security and stability of the region. Ershadi warned that if the Afghan situation is not addressed effectively, it could lead to a massive influx of refugees to neighboring countries. The U.S. has frozen all Afghan assets following the Taliban takeover of the country in August last year. Palestinians have held a funeral for a man who was shot dead by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank on Tuesday. Hundreds of people attended the ceremony, which took place in the Arub refugee camp north of the city of Al-Khalil. Israeli forces reportedly attacked the mourners with rubber bullets and tear gas canisters, leading to dozens of suffocation cases. Ammar Shafir Abu Afifa was shot dead near the city of Bethlehem. Israeli forces for several hours refused to hand over his body to Palestinians. Abu Afifa was the third Palestinian to be killed in separate Israeli raids on Tuesday. The Yemeni foreign minister denounces as shameful and ridiculous a UN Security Council resolution that extends an arms embargo on the Ansarullah movement. Hisham Sharaf said the UAE proposed motion has turned the spotlight on the UN body's double standards. He added that the move shows the Security Council serves the interests of Abu Dhabi and Riyadh that are committing acts of aggression against Yemen. The resolution was adopted on Monday. It came in the wake of retaliatory attacks by the Ansarullah movement against Saudi Arabia and the UAE. The Yemenis say their reprisal attacks are aimed at pushing the Saudi-led coalition, which includes the UAE, to stop a war that began in 2015. The war on Yemen has claimed hundreds of thousands of lives, the majority of them civilians.
Following the recent retaliatory attacks by the Yemeni army and its aerial strikes on Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, the United Nations Security Council imposed an arms embargo on Yemen's Ansarullah movement. This measure was proposed by the UAE in an attempt to curtail the military capabilities of the Yemeni army.
حظر بيع الأسلحة هو لم ليس بجديد
Arms embargo on Yemen is not new. As everyone knows, we are prohibited from even buying fuel and foodstuffs. Today, Yemenis are suffering from a severe fuel crisis due to the seizure of Yemeni oil ships by the Saudi-led coalition. The Yemeni army depends on the Yemeni military industries, which have proven to the world the growing military capabilities of Yemen. This resolution will not stop the Yemeni missile attacks, but rather will prompt the Yemeni army to intensify its retaliatory operations.
In a Twitter post, the member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Muhammad Ali al-Houthi, criticized the measure, saying it has ignored war crimes by the Saudi-led coalition. He noted that any arms embargo that does not apply to the Western-backed coalition has no value.
The Security Council's resolution will not affect Yemen in facing the Saudi-led war. The Yemeni army continues to make progress on all battlefronts, and this measure is only aimed at satisfying Saudi Arabia and its allies. The resolution also aims to prolong the war on Yemen and halt any move towards peace. We, as the Yemeni people, are besieged. Our airports and ports are closed, and we cannot buy weapons like other countries. So this decision will not have any effect.
Saudi Arabia and its allies have launched a deadly war on Yemen since the beginning of 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, many of them women and children. This has pushed the Yemeni army to escalate its retaliatory attacks against Saudi and Emirati territories.
Experts say the Yemeni army depends on local military industries in addition to the spoils of war left by the Saudi-led coalition's forces after escaping the battlefronts. They believe that the UN resolution will make no difference as Yemen is besieged by Saudi Arabia since the beginning of the war. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Major American media outlets oppose military aggression unless the United States is doing it, says Jeff Cohen Ryder in an article published under the heading, "So this is what it looks like when the corporate media opposes a war." Stay tuned for more. Having worked inside mainstream U.S. media during the beginning of the so-called War on Terror and run-up to the U.S. invasion of Iraq, the differences in today's war coverage are dizzying to many people. Unfortunately, there was virtually no focus on civilian death and agony when it was the U.S. military launching the invasions. After the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003 on false pretenses, made possible by U.S. mainstream media complicity that many people witnessed firsthand, civilian deaths were largely ignored and undercounted through the years. Shortly after the U.S. invaded Afghanistan in October 2001, leaked directives from CNN's management to its correspondents and anchors showed that the network was intent on playing down and rationalizing the killing and maiming of Afghan civilians by the U.S. military. One memo instructed CNN anchors that if they ever referenced Afghan civilian victims, they needed to quickly announce to their audience, "These U.S. military actions are in response to a terrorist attack that killed close to 5,000 innocent people in the U.S. Such language was mandatory," said the memo, adding, "Even though it may start sounding rot, it is important that we make this point each time." Noting the cursory U.S. television coverage of Afghan civilian casualties, a New York Times reporter wrote, "In the United States, television images of Afghan bombing victims are fleeting, cautioned between anchors or American officials explaining that such sights are one side of the story. In the rest of the world, however, images of wounded Afghan children curled in hospital beds or women rocking in despair over a baby's corpse beamed via satellite by the Qatar-based network Al Jazeera or CNN International are more frequent and lingering. The near blackout and coverage of the civilian toll continued for decades. In April of last year, NBC anchor Lester Holt did a summing-up report on Afghanistan as America's longest war by offering one and only one casualty figure: 2,300 American deaths. There was no mention of more than 70,000 Afghan civilian deaths since 2001, and no mention of a UN study that found in the first half of 2019, due mostly to aerial bombing, the U.S. and its allies killed more civilians than the enemy. As the so-called war on terror expanded to other countries, U.S. mainstream media remained largely uninterested in civilian victims of U.S. warfare and drone strikes. Invasions and military force by one country against another are clearly illegal under international law unless conducted in true self-defense or authorized by the UN Security Council. In coverage of Ukraine war, U.S. mainstream media have correctly, repeatedly, and without equivocation invoked international law and declared it illegal, as they did when Russia invaded Crimea in 2014. By contrast, when the United States illegally invaded or attacked country after country in recent decades, international law has almost never been invoked by mainstream U.S. media. That was surely the case in the lead-up to the Iraqi invasion, unlike in Britain, where major media prominently discussed the reality that invading Iraq would be a crime against international law unless authorized by a UN Security Council resolution. On a television special 6 weeks before the invasion, for example, Tony Blair was cross-examined on that point by anti-war citizens. In 1989, when the U.S. invaded Panama in perhaps the bloodiest drug bust in history, mainstream U.S. media made a determined effort to ignore international law and its violation, as well as the slaughter of civilians. Mainstream media in the U.S. today are outraged by imperialism. This is the born unwillingness to recognize U.S. imperialism persists, despite the fact that no country has come close to the U.S. in the last 7 years in imposing its will in changing the leadership of foreign governments. This denial persists despite the fact that the United States remains more than 750 military bases in nearly 80 foreign countries. That U.S. military budget dwarfs that of every other country, more than 12 times larger than Russia's. That the U.S. provides nearly 80% of the world's weapons exports, including weapons sales and military training to 40 of the 50 most oppressive anti-democratic regimes on Earth. Speaking of U.S. imperialism, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has been all over the news in recent days commenting on Ukraine. But her commentary reeks of hypocrisy on many grounds. One is her key role, largely ignored by mainstream U.S. media, in enabling the violent military coup regime that replaced elected Honduran President Manuel Zelaya in 2009.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Tit for tat measures underway while more Ukrainians are fleeing their country. Ukraine's president says defending the capital Kiev is his top priority, while Russia has promised to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. Reacting to developments in Ukraine, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the conflict there is the result of U.S. and Western policies. He cited Ukrainian and former Afghan presidents complaining of Washington leaving them high and dry. Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Let's see who's joining us in this edition of The Spotlight. We'll have Senior Research Fellow with Global Policy Institute George Zamuela joining us out of Budapest. Also with us will be Independent International Affairs Analyst Gilbert Doctorow from Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Good to see you, gentlemen. Now let me ask George this question. George, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky tweeted a few days ago that his country was left alone by the U.S. and the EU. Why did they betray Zelensky after Russia attacked Ukraine?
Well, just before I attempt to answer that question, I want to congratulate Gilbert. He was on few weeks ago with me, and he predicted that this would happen, and most people,
Most analysts didn't. He did. Well, to answer your question, though, I think that Zelensky was allowed himself to be used by the United States as a battering ram against Russia. I think, unfortunately, that Ukraine was ill-served by the United States and its allies, and this was the inevitable outcome. There was any number of opportunities as the crisis became more intense, particularly when President Putin started speaking about the Russia's red lines. And it should have been clear to the leaders of the West, Macron, Biden, Blinken, and the Germans, that the Russians were serious. And all Zelensky really had to do was at least to make a show of going ahead and talking. They badly let him down. They didn't explain to him that Russia is very serious. Instead, they allowed Ukraine to posture and to make declarations, open declarations, that we're not even going to legitimize the leaders of the Donetsk and Luhansk republics, even though the Minsk agreement explicitly states that the implementation of it requires negotiations between Kiev and the representatives of the Donetsk and Luhansk. They didn't tell him this. They allowed him to shoot his mouth off in Munich about Ukraine becoming a nuclear power. And, as I say, they let him down very badly, and they let Ukraine down very badly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, Gilbert, there are people who argue that Ukraine has fallen victim to the West policy, especially those of the U.S. And they argue that the crisis in Ukraine and the ensuing Russian war was instigated by Washington and its post-Cold War expansion of NATO toward Russian borders. What's your take? How do you see the West's role in the war in Ukraine?
Well, the United States, the foreign policy community in Washington, must be delighted that they have lured the Russian forces into a war with Ukraine, which Russia did not want. Mm-hmm. Back in December, Russia highlighted to Washington and to NATO its main concern, which was to sit down at a table and talk about changing the architecture of security in Europe, which for the last 25 years the Russians have found very unsatisfactory, discriminatory, and resulting in ever-increasing threats to their national security through the expansion of NATO to the east. So the NATO question was by itself the number one priority of Russia, and Ukraine was to a certain extent an exhibit A about what NATO was about, why NATO was a threat. Exhibit A has become the whole exhibit at the present, because the issue of Russian security has fallen by the wayside, which delights certainly the power elite in Washington. And yet that is not the case in the final analysis. In the final analysis, what is proceeding day by day in the Russian operations in Ukraine is an attempt to smash NATO to pieces. Because the credibility of NATO, the credibility of the United States, and its security umbrella to all of its charges in NATO is being put to the test. And so far, as your question indicated, the test is being failed by the United States. There was stated before the action began, and as a kind of bait to Russia to act, President Biden said that the United States would never send a soldier to fight to help Ukraine in any war with Russia. This was backed up by other NATO members, and it was perfectly clear that Ukraine was being set up for a disaster. But the United States had no interest in the welfare of Ukraine. That Ukraine is simply a tool that was being used to bait and, if they succeeded, to do great damage to Russian sovereignty and Russian national power.
I'm going to ask you a question about that, too. Okay. Now, let me ask George about British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's spokesman saying Monday that Western sanctions in retaliation for the invasion of Ukraine are designed to topple Russian President Vladimir Putin. Is the U.S. seeking regime change in Russia?
Yes. I think that's been a fairly explicit policy on the part of the U.S. They've been dreaming of a return to the Gorbachev-Yeltsin era, and they've been frustrated year after year by Putin. I mean, we know this from the Hillary Clinton time. You know, that was in 2011, that they were clearly organizing protests in Russia. They want Putin out. The problem, I think, is, and I think this is a serious one, which is that there's a increasingly a mood in the West for some kind of a confrontation with Russia. There doesn't seem to be any of the restraint that used to animate Western governments. I mean, even you know Eisenhower in 1956 over Hungary, Lyndon Johnson in 68 over Czechoslovakia, and then subsequently, which is there are certain red lines that you don't cross. And you don't even want to start going on that you're going to get into an armed conflict because that's just going to escalate into a very dangerous area. And unfortunately, too many Western leaders, such as Boris Johnson and Liz Truss and others, are talking openly about getting into some kind of a shooting war with Russia. This is so reckless, so absolutely disastrous, because I think the mood in Russia right now is that war, I mean, among the policymakers, that war with the West is inevitable. It may come now, it may come in 2-3 years, but it is coming. And I think that's a...
Gilbert, we also have a group of analysts who believe that the long-term goal of the crisis in Ukraine is to weaken Russia, you know, as part of Washington's willingness and crave for a unipolar world. Do you agree with them?
Well, yes, to contain Russia and to keep it down, that is clearly the objective. At the same time, coming back to the sanctions that have been imposed, which really match what was called previously the nuclear option, that is, devastating sanctions in the economic sphere. I think that the problem is that in Washington and in Brussels, they really don't understand Russia. They don't have the analytic skills, the intellectual skills, to deal with Russia as it is today. And the economic sanctions are very severe, but I think Russia expects them to be of short duration because this conflict will end sooner rather than later. The threats to Russian security and the regime or the government in place is not in that area. The issue for Russia is how it conducts this war in Ukraine. And for that reason, the Western press has misunderstood totally what's going on day by day, why it's going so slowly, and so forth. The Russian concern is in the nature of the war as a fratricidal war, as a kind of civil war between two peoples that have a common history and very close relations and great number of intermarriages, whereas I'm speaking about the Russian and the Ukrainian peoples. Mm-hmm. And for Russia, they have to proceed. The Kremlin has to proceed very carefully in its military operation, not to present mass slaughter in the American way of war, but to do surgical strikes, to destroy military objects, and to destroy those most radical and elements of the fighting forces in Ukraine, namely these battalions like the Azov Battalion that is now surrounded in the Mariupol region, and destroy them separately without taking on the ordinary soldiers, all of whom have mothers and girlfriends and perhaps even relatives in Russia, or not to mention, without doing significant damage to civilian infrastructure and to civilian people. So the Russian operation is working under constraints that have nothing to do with what Mr. Macron said, thought he was imposing on Vladimir Putin when they had their telephone call 2 days ago. Mm. Russia is proceeding with supreme caution, and the operation is taking longer and is more difficult than the American way of war, which is to march through with shock and awe and kill everything on your path.
And they call it peripheral damage.
Collateral damage of hundreds of thousands of civilians. Yes.
Now, George, Russia's war on Ukraine, many believe, has revealed glaring hypocrisies and racism that Western media and governments are fueling. Let me cite you an example that caused great anger, at least here in West Asia. Maybe you've seen that CBS News senior correspondent, Charlie Diagata. He was reporting from Ukrainian capital Kiev on Friday. He said, I'm quoting him, "This isn't a place, with all due respect, like Iraq or Afghanistan. It has seen conflict raging for decades. This is a relatively civilized, relatively European country." End of quote. So what is said is dehumanization of people of color and race and normalization of white supremacy, plain and simple, is it not?
Well, I think there is something of that. But, you know, you could also say that the dehumanization of Russians and before that, the dehumanization of Serbs was nonetheless played an important role in Western thinking. There is clearly a feeling that the Slavs, such as Russians and such as Serbs, are, you know, you don't want to use the old German expression, Untermenschen, but, you know, that's more or less what they think. So that's why when you think of what Russia is doing today, is basically much, much less destructive than what the United States did in Iraq, what the United States did in Afghanistan, what NATO did in Yugoslavia. I mean, we've had 5-6 days, and although the media are trying to whip up hysteria about the horrific civilian casualties, they don't have much to work with. And basically, there hasn't been anything of the scale of those U.S.-led operations that I refer to. So why is everyone so indignant? Well, because it's the Russians. Russians don't have the same rights and prerogatives as we Westerners do. When we do it, that's fine. But when they do it, it isn't. And that's in the same thing goes by with all this a lot of heated talk about violations of international law. Well, the United States has been violating international law left, right, and center. Yet never once has anyone tried to impose sanctions on the United States. Never once has the United States been banned from sporting competitions. Mm. Never once has United States oligarchs or very rich people been subjected to sanctions. So there's a very much a different set of standards that apply to the Westerners and to Russians.
Right. Now, on that note, let me ask Gilbert this question. Gilbert, the U.S. and its allies wage unprovoked wars and invasions in several countries: Afghanistan, Iraq, Sudan, Libya, Somalia, Palestine, and Yemen. And this without any U.N. authorization. It killed many people. So are we witnessing a good war, bad war dichotomy here? I mean, how do you explain this hypocrisy?
Well, hypocrisy is the small change of diplomacy everywhere in the world. It has been and it will be. So I wouldn't be in a state of shock over the double standards. That's to be expected. And I don't think that in the Kremlin they are suffering too much from any of the sanctions. You'll notice that the Russians have not responded to these sanctions, other than the banning of airspace, right, where they responded at once, but to the nuclear option, attacks on the central bank of Russia and so forth, they have so far done nothing. And that tells you that they don't believe that these sanctions will long endure and that they have in reserve compensatory sanctions that they are ready to impose if necessary. But there are no rush to do that. Now, what am I talking about? We all know that the BP has said it's going to divest its shares in Rosneft, which are about 20% of Rosneft and are worth at least $25 billion. They will take a beating on that, take a terrible loss, because it's hard to think who exactly, other than the Chinese, are going to stand up and present them with a check to buy their shares. That is the least of it. And the Russians, if they want to respond in like, can confiscate all of European property in Russia, which far exceeds in value whatever is being frozen in Russian assets in the West. But the Russians haven't been in haste to use those countermeasures, because they don't believe that this hysteria that we see today will last beyond a couple of weeks, during which time the problems will be resolved, including the whole question of Europe giving a fast-track admittance to Ukraine. Fast-track normally would mean 18 months. Ukraine, as it presently looks, will be lucky to stay in one piece beyond 2 or 3 weeks, after which it will probably be divided, reluctantly divided, by Russia, in collaboration with local people who are willing to work in and lead the new states.
Yeah. George, did you hear Gilbert's prediction? We'll wait for another 2-3 weeks and see if that comes true too. Okay, that was my last question, of course, but you just mentioned it now. Now, George, let's talk a little bit about the way European countries have been welcoming Ukrainians and fleeing the war in their country with open arms, which is, of course, a good thing. But they did not treat refugees from Middle East and Africa in, let's say, 2021. They were fleeing wars in their countries, and those wars were caused by the U.S. and NATO. They were responsible for that. Can you shed some light on this?
Well, I think it goes back to your earlier point about hypocrisy. And if you remember, a couple of months ago, we had another bout of hysteria about this was involved Poland and Belarus. And the Poles were absolutely beside themselves over the prospect of 3,000 refugees or migrants or whatever you will, coming across the border from Belarus, and the EU was indignant about it, and NATO, and everybody condemned Belarus, and of course by implication Russia, that these people were on the border, and in fact Poland unleashed a cold water hose. This was late November, so that's pretty nasty. And again, you know, everyone just blamed Belarus and Russia. So yes, there's very much double standards, and it's you know, even applies to Viktor Orban, you know, who's been the great champion in Europe of saying no to migrants. He apparently is welcoming migrants from Ukraine, and so that, you know, that might cause him some political problems. But yeah, I mean, I think that the Europeans are doing an awful lot of posturing. You know, there's obviously with the migrants, but with a lot of very heated bluster in regard to what they're going to do with the Russians. We're going to take on Putin in Ukraine. Well, the Europeans haven't heard a shot fired in anger, you know, for decades, 75 years. So therefore, the only power capable of fighting Russia is the United States. So it's basically, they're not going to do any fighting. It's going to have to be the United States. And so far, the U.S. is trying to tamp down this war fever, saying, no, we're not going to be setting up no-fly zones. No, we're not going to get directly involved. So I think the Europeans are behaving in absolutely ridiculous fashion.
Okay. Now, Gilbert, we have only 30 seconds if you want to add to your comments, especially your prediction.
Well, it's very difficult to be wise. The situation on the ground changes. I believe that Mr. Putin and his immediate advisors are extremely flexible and have been revising and will continue to revise both strategy and tactics depending on what they see on the ground. And so for us on the sidelines as commentators, it is extremely difficult to predict with any degree of reliability what will happen 2 or 3 weeks from now. But there are just some indications, as I said, that a likely split up of the Ukraine, supervised by the Russians, is in the cards. Whether that happens will depend on the rulers in Kiev presently and how they react to the Russian advances.
Okay, on that note, we come to the end of this show. Let me thank our guests. We had Senior Research Fellow with Global Policy Institute, George Zamuel in Budapest, and Independent International Affairs Analyst, Gilbert Doctor in Brussels. Thank you. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi, and I'll see you next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, ladies and gentlemen from each and every single corner of the world, hope everything is just fine with you. Whatever you're doing, driving your car, walking on your feet, going back to home after a long day, or just resting at home, I welcome your entrance to an extraordinary zone. You're hearing me from IRB English Radio. Get ready to fly with us in the realm of reality with a new episode of your program, Back to Reality. This is Asma at your service as your host, and here with me I have two very dear guests, Sister Zainab and Brother Habib. Very happy to have you both in here.
Assalamu alaikum. I'm also happy to be with you always.
Yes,
everywhere.
I'm always glad to be with you.
And alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me on board.
Yes, thank you for being here. Welcome to your program. Well, today we're going to talk about a very crucial issue, which is so evident these days. We feel that there is a need to be distracted from the modern life, right? Modern life has made us so tired, isn't it?
Yes, and anyone wants proof, just go ahead and look a picture of my face. That's the best proof. Nothing else. Really, just that. Look at my schedule and go ahead and see.
Yes, modern life has got many advantages for us, but at the same time, it has brought so much of
Stressed with it.
Yes. Stress. So much of pressure. You feel like you have to go and run with the currents, but there is nothing after it. You know what I mean?
Exactly, yeah. The more we think that the modern life has made us, the advancement has came and it has made our lives easier, the more tougher it has made. We have less picnics with our families. Yes. We have less time with for our loved mm-hmm. ones. We hardly see the smile of our kids around. We hardly see the smile of the parents.
We don't notice the little things.
Exactly. For example, today we have a social media world wherein I don't think the previous generations...
Which is virtual. And we are not enjoying it.
I don't think our parents have any experience of it, or our grandparents have been in this world. Our grandkids, like to the for our grandparents, their grandkids are living in a world which our grandparents do not know. This world is so deep.
And I think our grandparents, they lived happier.
Of course.
And they were more satisfied with their life.
And they were more healthy, you know.
Maybe they didn't have so much of money, but they were happier, healthier.
They didn't have money. I'm sorry to excuse me here. My grandparents had money. I'm very sorry to tell you that.
I mean,
and they had all the free
thing.
Time in the world. You know, it was you wake up in the morning, right?
Yes.
You pray Salat al-Fajr. Then my grandfather would go to the farm.
Mm-hmm.
And he would, you know, pick up tobacco.
Such a beautiful life to have a farm.
He had chickens and lambs.
Oh my God, that's so good.
That's very beautiful. And then
yes.
you go back and then you sell. And the cash is available. The costs were low as well. So I think that it's not about, you know, the not having money. I think there's this saying about, which really answers this question, is the saying of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam in the book of Tawheed al-Mufaddal Fakir. But there's this concept. Why did Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala create sleep? You just ask yourself. We call Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala Ar-Rabb. The Lord,
exactly.
The one that arranges everything for us to reach perfection. And one of the reasons why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala created night, sleep, is that because human beings are greedy. And when they have the chance, and if they had the chance, like the chance,
we
will not relax on a dollar. We'll keep on running until we are Elon Musk or until we are Jeff Bezos.
There would be no time for refreshing your mind.
Yes, and that is why we see that, I see this on social media, that people who want to be successful must sleep less, sleep 6 hours, sleep 4 hours.
Yes.
No, take your time. I remember Mirza Jawad Tabrizi, one of the great scholars that was available in our times. He was asked, and I was a little boy, and I heard him saying that the most thing that I regret is that I used to stay up at night.
Oh.
Yes. And that really stuck with me because I was sleeping at that time for 4 hours. Now it's 6 hours. It's not any better. But, you know, that really just stuck to me. Like, you feel that. It's not when you're 16, 17, you feel
and
it.
And it's not a common person telling that. It's a scholar.
Yeah.
You know?
You feel that when you're like 30.
Of course,
who's advising people to study as well.
Exactly. Of course, if he had sleepless nights, he had that for studies.
Yes, that is true. We also have this saying from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam and Imam Baqir. That state it is unrecommended, makruh, not loved in Islam, not recommended, to stay up at night, unless one of three, reciting the Quran, gaining knowledge, or because it's your wedding night.
Exactly.
One of the three.
All
Other
the
than
three
that,
purposes are
go to sleep,
Allah.
Go relax, and really just look at the mental state of people. And I'm certain, I still haven't made my studies yet because, you know, I'm not a scientist, but I read. And I've noticed something, that when sleep lessens, the mental health issues grow.
Exactly. If you sleep less, obviously, you are not refreshing your mind. You're just having sleepless nights.
But modernity has brought that into our lives.
No, but in the morning, however, if you sleep late, you wake up late. And when you wake up late, you have those headaches. You have those, you know, you wake
you're cranky,
up
cranky. You don't have any energy for the world.
Exactly.
Yes.
You start
Maybe
your day
headaches.
With that bad mood.
Yes,
you start
bad
your day.
Mood. So
they become sensitive. I've read this on Reddit, actually. People with mental health issues were asked, you know, on Ask Reddit, what was one of the best things to do or your therapist gave you for your mental health issues. One of them was whenever you feel like sensitive and whatever, go to sleep. Go to sleep. When you wake up, and he says that was the best advice ever. Why? Because whenever I feel like sensitive, oh, this person might be sad with me. This person might be, you know, not happy with me, not satisfied with me. When you go to sleep, you wake up, you're like, all right, who cares?
Maybe if you get enough of a sleep, then you would have a better brain to think and give you some solutions.
A fresh brain, exactly.
Refreshment,
And we basically have these sleepless nights and we are so much into this modern tech world just because of money. And see how beautiful Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, He suggests us, Lady Zahra, salamu alayhi, he says, if you want barakat in your life, if you want, you know, to have more provision, to have
blessings
and all in your life, then you should do what? Wake up in between time from the Fajr,
yes,
the morning Fajr prayers, mm-hmm, until the sun rises.
Yes.
You know, in this time, just pray to God. Be with God.
Yes, yes.
And your, you know, blessings, you'll get so many blessings. They'll shower on you like anything.
Mm-hmm. My mother always says the doors of the sky are open in that time.
Exactly.
The better thing would be, like, to really just tell people,